A deep dive into asteroid Bennu with Dante Loretta, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome, I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society, with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. It was just last week that we celebrated the successful collection of material from that asteroid that the OSIRIS-REx spacecraft has been circling for nearly 2 years. Now we know just how successful that encounter was. Principal Investigator Dante Loretta is here with the exciting and surprising details. First, though, we'll look to the future and a new proposal for orbiting and landing on Saturn's moon Enceladus. The night sky still beckons, and Bruce Betts answers the call. We'll also congratulate a first-time winner of our space trivia contest. The Downlink is the Planetary Society's weekly newsletter. It's a great place to start your own exploration of the solar system, and it's topped this week by an explosive image of that encounter with Bennu. I mean that pretty much literally, as what looks like scores of small fragments explode away from the sample collector on OSIRIS-REx. Up on Mars, the long-suffering, long-striving mole is entirely beneath the surface. The InSight lander scoop is piling more Martian dirt on top of the hole in what I've just realized may be Mars' first construction project. It may take months, but the InSight team hopes the mole will still dig much deeper to reveal much more about the interior of the red planet. From Mars to Pluto, where data collected by New Horizons has explained how the planet, not a planet, take your pick, has formed ice caps on its mountains. It's not how they form on Earth, by the way. And the men and women living on board the International Space Station can breathe easy again. The small but persistent air leak has been found and plugged. You'll find lots more at planetary.org/downlink. Who doesn't want to fly through those salty plumes emanating from the so-called tiger stripes at the South Pole of Enceladus? Sending a mission to build on the work accomplished by the Cassini spacecraft has come up many times on our show. Well then, how about not just an orbiter, but a lander? I talked a few days ago with space journalist and author Nancy Atkinson about her October 8th article at planetary.org. Nancy, welcome. It's great to have you on to talk about this terrific article about Orbilander, a mission I hadn't heard of until I read your article. Tell us about this proposal for a trip to Enceladus.
Right. It's a really fascinating topic. It's part of the decadal survey, kind of an independent assessment that NASA gets to see the priorities of scientific community and guidance in deciding where to send future missions. There was a group of scientists at Johns Hopkins University that put together an idea, this kind of study, to send a mission to Enceladus. You know, Enceladus is just such a fascinating place in our solar system. These scientists realize that we probably have one shot in our lifetimes of getting a mission to Enceladus. So why not go for the gold, pull out all the stops, and make it a big flagship mission? Plus, we already know that Enceladus has a habitable environment. You know, it's got a subsurface ocean, and the interior of this little moon is just warm enough to keep it liquid water. Plus, we have these majestic plumes that we've seen in the Cassini images that show us that there's warm hydrothermal vents on the surface. So all evidence points to an environment that's very conducive to life. So this mission would kind of cut to the chase and ask the big question, is there life on Enceladus?
I wasn't very far into your great article when I was struck by the similarities between this proposed mission and the Viking orbiters and landers of more than four decades ago that went to Mars. For one thing, that they're going to get there and orbit for a while, because as great as Cassini was, we didn't get close up enough images of Enceladus, I guess, to safely put something down on the surface. And then this orbiter will, on its own, turn into a lander?
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And I think it's the only mission that's ever been designed to be both an orbiter and a lander with one spacecraft. I guess the closest thing we saw to that was what happened just the other day with OSIRIS-REx, where it briefly touched down on the asteroid Bennu. And they would plan to orbit Enceladus for approximately 200 days. They'd study the moon with all sorts of instruments. Enceladus gives us this benefit of having these plumes. So they would fly through the plumes repeatedly and collect particles and analyze them on an onboard chemistry lab. But the exciting part was while they would be in orbit, they would also be doing reconnaissance. They'd be taking high-resolution pictures of the surface and look for a great landing spot. When it was time, they would pick this spot and they would turn the spacecraft on its side and turn it into a lander. You know, they would try to land, I guess, close to the one of these jets or plumes on the surface and capture particles before the particles came back down and hit the ground.
I got to bring up one more thing that I pulled from the mission concept study, which is that these scientists expect that when this lander descends to the surface and starts to work, it will be able to detect life that is 500,000 times as scarce as it is in our own planet Earth's oceans. That is just mind-boggling.
It really is. Yeah, some of the life detection instruments that they have are pretty impressive. Mass spectrometers, microscopes, cell sequencers. But then they've got all those remote sensing instruments as well that'll really give us a well-rounded picture of Enceladus's environment and hopefully some of its interior aspects as well.
Nancy, thank you for this terrific introduction to the Orbilander mission concept, now under consideration in this brand new decadal study. We'll be following along.
Thanks a lot, Matt. It was really fun to write about that. It is just a really fascinating topic.
That is space journalist and author Nancy Atkinson, who writes for Universe Today, the National Space Society's Ad Astra, and, I'm very proud to say, the Planetary Society. Her most recent book, and it's terrific, is 8 Years to the Moon, the History of the Apollo Missions, which takes you deep into the contributions of the people who built the Apollo program and the spacecraft that took humans to the moon. Nancy's also a NASA JPL Solar System Ambassador. Listen carefully, because I'm only going to say this once. Origins, spectral interpretation, resource identification, security, regolith, explorer. That's OSIRIS-REx, which last week really did prove itself to be solar system royalty. Dante Loretta is the power behind the throne. The University of Arizona planetary scientist and professor leads the mission as its principal investigator. As you're about to hear, the successful collection of that sample was not the last step before the spacecraft begins the long journey home. It may be useful to remember that the dirty work was performed beautifully by TagSAM, the touch-and-go sample acquisition mechanism. By the way, some of you may remember that the asteroid previously known as 1999 RQ36 got the name Bennu in 2013, when the University of Arizona, MIT, and the Planetary Society announced that 8-year-old Mario Puzio's submission had been picked from among 8,000 as the winner of our contest. Dante, welcome back and congratulations. We listened to the thrilling moment when you and your team got confirmation of contact with Bennu. You worked on this mission for over a decade before that accomplishment. Are you still feeling the high?
Hey, Matt, absolutely. It's great to be back here. It has been an unbelievable week. It's hard to believe it's only been a week since the tag event itself, but it exceeded all of our expectations. Absolutely amazing.
Okay, so first that spectacular video of the contact with Bennu, which I've probably watched 30, 40 times by now. Then, just 2 days later, confirmation that a sample had been collected with that equally amazing sequence of images. Absolutely spectacular. I just don't have another word for it. Well, I could come up with others, but they'd be words like amazing and stunning.
Absolutely. Yes. There's a lot of good news in those images, and we've been analyzing them intently in order to get the approval to go ahead and stow the sample. So there's quite a lot we could cover here if you want to get into some of the analysis that we did to determine sampling success.
I sure do. But first, I want to hear about the news that just came out, well, just minutes really before we're speaking, which is on Monday afternoon. It was just announced that you will be stowing the collector head tomorrow as we speak, October 27th. So no more fist bumps with Bennu?
That's right. We are confident that the tag event was highly successful, and we are in the contingency where we're observing a small amount of mass loss from that TagSAM device. So we have all agreed, all the way up to Thomas Zurbuchen at the NASA headquarters, that the most important thing for us to do is to get that head inside the science canister, which is inside the sample return capsule, which is the safest place for it to be, because that'll contain all the sample all the way through delivery to the surface of the Earth.
You described it on Friday during that media briefing as having had almost too much success because of the amount of material that has been collected, and it's actually blocking open this membrane, right, which is supposed to prevent that escape?
That's right. Our bucket is full, and we tried to cram even more stuff in there than it could accommodate, so it's literally appears to be overflowing with material.
Just amazing. You're going to be stowing tomorrow. Hopefully that will go well. But you still have to wait until, what, March before you can start the long journey back to Earth?
That's right. And just to be clear, we're going to begin the stow sequencing tomorrow. That's Tuesday, October 27th. We may get stow, at least the tagsam head captured into the capture ring. But we're also planning that we may be operating all day Wednesday as well. We're on 24/7 shifts here, triple shifts in the operations center, because we just want to keep moving forward on this activity until it's complete. It is a tricky mechanical interface in deep space, and we're operating what we call telerobotically. So we're sending commands. Spacecraft is moving the arm or taking images or opening the SRC, whatever we just told it to do. And then we're taking images and we're verifying that on the ground before we proceed to the next step. It's a very different mode of operation for us. And as you can imagine, painstakingly slow, because you have that 37 minute round trip light time that you got to wait for each of those steps to proceed.
So this is not an automated procedure. It's something where it's done command by command from the ground via the deep space network.
That's right.
Wow. Is there any concern that that material, some of which is adhering to the exterior of the sample collector, the collector head, that it might interfere with the process of collecting, of stowing that head?
That is exactly the concern that we have. Yeah, that, and we've already identified this in what we call a contingency plan. So the first thing we did was we pulled out the procedure document for stowing sample. And we said, are we in a new situation, something that we've never thought about, or, you know, we don't have a contingency plan on the shelf identified? And we definitely thought that there might be a mechanical interference, that there might be what we thought was something protruding out of the base of TAGSAM that could interfere with that capture ring. That's not exactly what the situation is. What we're thinking now is something may fall out of TAGSAM and then onto that capture ring. And there are a series of latches that will grab the TAGSAM head. The best analogy I can think of is, if you've ever gone skiing, it's kind of like clicking your ski boot into your ski, right? And you got to get that toe in, and then you got to lock the heel down behind you. And if you've got a little bit of snow or something in there, it doesn't always go right, especially if you've never worn skis before. So the last time we tried to stow the TAGSAM head into the sample return capsule was here on the ground in Denver, Colorado, in the lab. So we've done it all before. It wasn't easy. It took multiple attempts, even here with technicians all around the spacecraft watching everything proceed. So we know it's a very delicate maneuver, and that's why we're going to this telerobotic sequential mode of operation.
I sure hope that you get it on the first try, but I'm certainly also glad that you and your team have planned for any contingencies. You know, I hadn't noticed until last week how similar the TAGSAM collector head looks to a much more mundane device, the air filter on my car's engine. Mm-hmm. Are there other similarities?
That's basically the technology that we're going for. It is an air filter for all practical purposes, with the exception that we went to an airless body, asteroid Bennu, and we had to bring our own air, which we did, and which seems to have worked really well. So we're very confident that that filter, it probably was full when we backed away from the asteroid. And now what we're seeing is the particles appear to have become emitting from the TAGSAM head as a result of moving the arm into those positions to get those camera shots so that we could verify the TAGSAM collection efficiency. You're in microgravity, you have all of this regolith in this head, and it's fluidized, basically. It behaves like a fluid. And I think you just have a diffusion problem where we have a gap in this Mylar flat because we tried to cram some big rocks in there apparently at the end. So they're kind of wedging it open a little bit. And we've literally been able to see particles show up over the lip. It's like a random walk. They're kind of bouncing around and then they just hit the back of the tag sam and they just come right towards us, towards the camera and slip out. So it really is this, you could think of it as kind of Brownian motion. All these particles are just bouncing around inside the tag sam head. And every once in a while, one of them gets itself on a trajectory where it hits that little gap and slips out.
Physics. It's all physics.
It is all physics in microgravity, which is not always intuitive.
Are you confident that if you're able to get it stowed properly tomorrow, maybe Wednesday, you're still going to have a whole bunch of bits of Bennu to bring back to Earth?
We are confident, Matt, that we have a lot of sample in that tag sam head. And we feel very confident that the few grams that we see leaking out is just slosh of material that's inside that head in much, much higher abundances.
Sure sounds like you hit the jackpot on the first try. And it was exciting as it descended, as we were watching, listening in real time. You'd hear someone say that the margin of error, I forget the exact term, is 1 meter or a half meter. Mm-hmm. You really hit the bullseye, didn't you?
We really did. We definitely hit within a meter of the target location. And I think we've done better than that. We actually have a couple different groups reconstructing the contact point. But we're a substantial fraction of a meter at this point to the target point. It's just right, like you said, it was an absolute bullseye. And especially because the area that we touched down on had so many fine grain particles, which was really what the target was anyways, whether it was the exact coordinate we programmed or just a little bit off to the west. It was a really great location.
I got a quote for you from Administrator Bridenstine, Jim Bridenstine of NASA. This amazing first for NASA demonstrates how an incredible team from across the country came together and persevered through incredible challenges to expand the boundaries of knowledge. Our industry, academic, and international partners have made it possible to hold a piece of the most ancient solar system in our hands. You want to say anything about those partners?
Yeah, it's all about the team and how amazing this group of people are to work with. I'm at the University of Arizona, and the University of Arizona team was responsible for the science processing and operation. So all of those great data products that we brought back, all of those observations were designed by the crew at U of A. And we're really tightly coupled with our team here at Lockheed Martin in Littleton, Colorado. They built the spacecraft. They operate the spacecraft. The team here is just such a great crew of people. They're so much fun to be around. And then our NASA Goddard Space Flight Center team, where the project management is based, as well as Flight Dynamics Leadership. Kinetics Aerospace, which is the group of people that lead the navigation efforts for the program. We had that phenomenal laser altimeter, the OLA instrument from the Canadian Space Agency, which mapped the surface of the asteroid with centimeter scale precision, an amazing data set that we'll be processing for decades to come. And really excited to work with our partners in Japan, the JAXA team on the Hayabusa 2 mission. We've got a lot of great dialogue going back and forth. We've already done comparative analysis of the Hayabusa 2 touchdowns with the OSIRIS-REx sampling event. And of course, their samples are coming back in just a couple short months, and we're all excited to see what they have got from asteroid Yugu. And that really kicks off the sample analysis program for us, because we've always looked at it not as two programs, but as one continuous sample analysis phase that starts with Hayabusa 2 and then receives OSIRIS-REx samples 2 years later. And that just keeps going for 5 years or so. And we have this amazing ability to compare and contrast samples from these two different asteroids. There's really an amazing period of asteroid science coming up for us here.
Dante, if you can spare one more minute, you know, Bruce Betts offers a space trivia contest question for us each week on the show. This was the question: the name of the original principal investigator for OSIRIS-REx. Would you like to say something about your mentor?
Yeah, the correct answer is Dr. Michael Drake. He was the director of the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory when I was hired there. We immediately became friends, and he was a great mentor for me. First of all, he hired me, which is a huge step of, you know, a sign of endorsement there. And then we really worked very closely together for 7 years. designing and refining this mission concept to the point where by in 2011, NASA awarded us OSIRIS-REx as New Frontiers 3. Mike passed away in September of that year, and it was a crushing blow to me and to the team to lose the leadership like that. But Mike empowered me, he motivated me, and he told me to take this team forward and to bring that sample from Bennu back to the Earth. I know he's incredibly proud of the team. We all felt like he was there in spirit on Tuesday, and he's just as excited to see what those samples are going to be made of as the rest of us. So a lot of this is done for Mike, and I'm eternally grateful for believing in me and for giving me this opportunity.
Thank you, Dante, for that tribute, but also for sharing all of this with the listeners to this show and to fans of the OSIRIS-REx mission around the world. I will let you get back to getting ready to bring those samples back home, where I know there are so many scientists who cannot wait to get their hands on them. Thanks again for taking the time today, and best of luck as you seal up that capsule.
Thank you, Matt. If everything goes according to plan, we should be announcing successful stow by Friday at the latest of this week.
That's Dante Loretta. He is a professor in the Lunar and Planetary Lab at the University of Arizona and principal investigator for the OSIRIS-REx mission that has just successfully collected a sample from an asteroid known as Bennu. He's also the creator of the popular space exploration board games Extranaut and Downlink and the astronomy game Constellations. Back with Bruce Betts and What's Up in a minute. You're listening to Planetary Radio.
Hi, this is Kate from the Planetary Society. How does space spark your creativity? We want to hear from you. Whether you make cosmic art, take photos through a telescope, write haikus about the planets, or invent space games for your family, really any creative activity that's space-related, we invite you to share it with us. You can add your work to our collection by emailing it to us at connect@planetary.org. That's connect@planetary.org. Thanks!
Hey, Planetary Radio listeners, the Planetary Society now has an official online store. We've teamed up with Chop Shop, known for their space mission posters, to bring you space-inspired art and merchandise. You can find exclusive Planetary Society t-shirts, posters, and more. Visit planetly/spaceshop to learn more. That's planet.ly/spaceshop.
Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio, once again bringing you the Chief Scientist of the Planetary Society, Bruce Betts. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be back.
From Mel Powell in California, he had yet another response to your request for call signs for me in my Air Force career, flying that F-22. I don't know why I didn't think of this. Mel says I should be 1T. He says, how often in life have you had to say it's with one T? Basically, the entire lifetime, Mel. Thank you very much. He also says, say hi to Factoid. Hey there, Factoid. What's up?
Hello. Well, one T. There's a blue moon that will not actually be blue on October 31st, Halloween. Blue moon, usually defined as the second full moon in 1 month. Also that day, Uranus is at opposition, opposite side of the Earth from the sun, so rising in the east around sunset, setting in the west around sunrise. And so get a finder chart. You'll need dark skies or some binoculars or a telescope to see it, but now's the best time. We've also got the bright stuff. Well, I mean, the blue moon will definitely be bright. Jupiter and Saturn in the evening sky in the west, southwest. Jupiter looking super bright, Saturn looking yellowish. They'll be getting closer over the next couple months. And then Mars coming up in the early evening in the east, still looking super bright. It will be hanging out next to the getting full moon on October 29th, on Thursday. And in the pre-dawn east, we've still got super bright Venus. So lots going on.
Was out there last night, saw all of them, not Uranus, but the others, and got out the telescope at the request of my 4-year-old grandson, and we took a look at the waxing moon.
Nice. Wax on. All right. This we go to This Week in Space History. Amazingly, 20 years ago, the first crew took occupancy of the International Space Station. And there have been people there continuously for 20 years. 20 years that we've not had all of the humans on Earth. On to random space fact.
Can I finish that? Random space fact. Random space fact. Random space fact. Random space fact. Random space fact.
Thank you, Matt. That was delightful.
You're welcome.
So, on Alan Bean's suggestion, the Apollo 12 mission patch has four stars on it, one for each of the three astronauts who flew the mission and one for Clifton Curtis C.C. Williams, who Bean replaced after Williams was killed in a T-38 crash caused by mechanical failure.
Oh, I remember that. Very sad. Nice tribute, though.
All right, we move on to the trivia contest. As you know, I asked who was the original principal investigator of the OSIRIS-REx mission, and I believe our winner this week is Dante Loretta from Arizona.
Well, congratulations, Dante. We would send you a rubber asteroid, but you already have a rugged rock and sand one, so, you know, the heck with that. Now, we have a real winner, too. And it's Laura Weller in the UK, longtime listener, first-time winner, who said Dr. Michael J. Drake, who, as we heard from Dante, hired Dante at the University of Arizona, became his mentor and good friend. Laura, that has gotten you a Planetary Society kick asteroid, rubber asteroid. Sorry, we can't pull in Bennu for you, but hopefully rubber will do.
Maybe in a few years.
From Darren Ritchie, in Washington, congratulations to the entire team on a successful touchdown and sample capture. I can't imagine a better tribute to Dr. Drake's audacious vision. Now, get home safe. Thank you, Darren. Thank you, everybody. We're ready for another.
Speaking of asteroids that aren't made of rubber, as measured by either volume or average diameter, what is the smallest asteroid that has been visited by a spacecraft? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
Good one. I don't know this one, so I'm going to depend on all of you to send in the answer and educate me, but you got to do it if you want to be eligible for our prize by Wednesday, November 4th at 8 a.m. Pacific time. And that prize, well, what else? A Planetary Society kick asteroid, rubber asteroid. Bruce, we're done.
And everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about air filters. Thank you, and good night.
Like car air filters that look like TagSam devices on the ends of long arms on spacecraft that are crammed full of Bennu bits. New breakfast cereal, Bennu bits. That's Bruce Betts, the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, who's designing the box that Bennu bits come in right now as we speak. And we'll again next time on What's Up.
Cartoon Matt chowing down on Bennu bits.
Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its members who really dig space exploration. Mark Hilverde is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. Ad Astra.